This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'd like to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Jason Silverman. He's a filmmaker. He's director of the Cinematheque at the CCA. Welcome back to the Radio Cafe.
It's so great to be here.
You know, you have been, I don't know how you do it, you've been doing so much over the last few years. You've been running an absolutely stellar film program at the CCA, and you've been making your own film, which is called Semben, which is about the father of African cinema, which is, I guess it's going to be, it's opening in festivals all over the place. It's opened in New York City, and it's opening in Santa Fe in January.
That's right. Semben.
Semben.
You saw it.
I did see it, and it's a wonderful documentary, and it's fascinating because this whole story of, and we'll talk about it when it gets closer to the event at the Lensic, but this whole story about how a young man comes to be, a young African man, totally working class, comes to be a filmmaker, and how he takes on this role of really being a voice and giving voice to stories that were normally really just told through oral tradition.
Yeah. No, I mean, he saw a need in the world, and he was a guy with a tremendous willpower, and the need he saw was to maintain African culture or promote African culture and make sure that Africans had a sense of their own identity, because it was being lost first through, you know, the colonial project, and then through the post-colonial project, you know, where the Africans were theoretically running their countries, but there was a lot of, you know, invisible hand behind it. And so he just saw his cultures disappearing, and so he could have been anything. He probably could have been president, or you know, or a general, or a business titan, but he decided to be a storyteller. He thought that was the most important thing to do with his energy.
Yeah, I mean, talk about forces of nature.
Yeah, this guy, Usman Semben.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we'll talk about more about Usman Semben, because your collaborator on the film has also written a book, which has just come out, and so we'll do a show on that. But I want to talk about some other stuff that's going on at the CCA right now. There is an 8-film series, I guess it's one every weekend, that opens tomorrow. And it's called Masters Exhibitions on Screen. And it's about, well, artists and art exhibitions and museums and that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, you know, there's these incredible exhibits have been being produced at major museums. And it's been going on for a long time, but they've really become extravaganzas, you know, almost like, you know, big sporting events.
Yeah.
So there'll be years in the making, and they'll feature all kinds of restored works, and then they'll have the world's attention, and there'll be massive lines around the block, that kind of thing.
So, and that's how the museum stays solvent.
And they're really incredible productions. And so this series is of films by a production team that specializes in documenting these exhibits. And it's really interesting to see. For anyone who's involved in events, anyone who's into fine art, you know, and what happens with these, there's a formula for these pieces, but they're all really interesting, is you see the lead up to the exhibit, including some of the restoration work. You learn about the artist, and the artists include the Impressionists and Van Gogh and Monet, and those are some of the subjects of the films. And you'll be there at opening night talking to curators, and then you'll investigate using really beautiful, exquisite HD cinematography the works in detail in a way that you almost can't do when you're there in person, especially when with these monster crowds.
Yeah, that's true.
So
isn't it?
You're in the theater looking at this giant screen, and you're seeing these paintings that you've seen in books or you've seen from across, you know, the velvet rope. And you're really getting to see the brushstrokes and the detail in a way that you haven't seen before. It's a real immersion. They're really interesting. It's 90 minutes of access behind the scenes and all kinds of interesting context, and then really close study of a few important works.
Now, all of these films are made, as you said, by the same production team?
They are, yeah.
And so you are seeing it kind of, I mean, this is the thing, no matter how great the perspective is and the lighting and all that, you're still seeing it through the eyes of somebody else.
You are. You can't experience the art on a screen the way you'd experience it in person, of course. But it can deepen your appreciation and your understanding and give you some context to get closer to the work, I think. So when I watch them, I want to go see the works themselves. That's the impulse that I have.
Yeah, yeah. I once was talking to a museum, I think it was a museum director, a museum curator, and they were talking about how, like it or not, museums have to have these blockbuster shows because that brings in the money, not only through ticket sales, but through all the merchandise
T-shirts
and all of that stuff. And we were saying, well, what kind of shows do people like to see? He goes, oh, it's a formula. There's Impressionists, there's Egyptians, and there's gold. And if you could do a show called Egyptian Gold of the Impressionists, you know, you'd cash in.
It's just like the dinosaurs at the Natural History Museum.
Right.
You got to have your dinosaurs. But there's a reason that those subjects are popular. I mean, particularly the Egyptians and the Impressionists. It's just the work is good and relatable, and so people love it, you know. The list of films that's in the series is a best of, you know, album. You know, it's the Impressionists and
Vermeer
and Van Gogh and Monet and Edvard Munch and Rembrandt, Matisse. So it's, in that way, it's predictable. That being said, it's still really fun to see. I do hope that the series is ongoing, so we'll probably be able to do another one next year. And I hope there will be a little more diversity in terms of the period of time that they cover, and also just, you know, this is a white male lineup, so I hope that there'll be other, and we investigated finding some things that were not part of this series that we could include that would broaden the discussion a little bit, and we'll probably do that for a second series.
Well, maybe this will also inspire these filmmakers or others to do films on, say, African art or Indian art or South American or Aztec or whatever.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of interesting work being done in museums, and I think that's the bigger point of this. It's kind of a celebration of curation and of museum studies, and it doesn't set out to do that, but the people who really love art and dedicate their lives to art, they deserve a moment in the spotlight too.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing. So you can buy a pass for the whole series if you want to, ccasantafe.org. There's also some other really amazing stuff coming up. I just saw you had a little press screening for a film by Laurie Anderson, who is an amazing artist in many media.
Yeah.
Heart of a Dog, that's what it's called.
Right. And I figured you'd be the target audience for
dog.
This. It has the word dog in it.
It has the word dog in it.
And the first image you see is a dog.
Dog is my favorite word in the English language.
That's right. And well, so.
But it's about more than dogs.
Well, I have been thinking about this film nonstop since I saw it.
I have too.
We had and you and I had an interesting conversation about it, because it's a series of impressions that Laurie Anderson has upon the death of her dog Lolabelle, which was right around the time that her husband Lou Reed died. So he is the kind of subtext of this too. And the film's really about trying to understand what happens when we die or when we say goodbye, but it's really broader than that. And we were talking about whether all of these impressions had a little hidden structure, like a subterranean structure. And the more I think about it, the more I feel like this is really a kind of an exquisitely structured film, one where you don't see the connections, but you feel them. And when you get to the end of the film, you feel like you've seen a real complete work of art. She's really, you know, she's known for her performance art. She's also a writer and a poet, a visual artist. And, you know, she's recorded music in studio, and So this is a work that brings together a lot of that, you know, her interests as an artist together and into one place. And I've heard her speak about the film, and for her, making the film was a healing process too.
I find it fascinating that it's a whole film about death made not long after her husband died and doesn't mention him.
I know. You see him at the end.
Yeah. You see one photograph that's clearly him, but he's not mentioned at all.
Yeah. There's a lot in that film that I think got into my, you know, deep into my system. I think that film is one of those films that's going to live with me for a long time. So, and that opens on December 11th. Yeah. And it's really, I think it's a film that Santa Fe will really connect with. It's not just because of the dogs. Of course, our dog population will come. And it's beautiful about dogs. You know, one of the things I love about it is that you get a dog's eye view of the world.
Yeah, and she made a little doggy cam, like dog level
camera. And then put filters on to show what a dog might actually see in the way that a dog sees.
Yeah.
And a dog's sight is enhanced by, which is limited, but a dog's sight is enhanced by its sense of smell.
Yeah, that's right. There was a wonderful documentary out of Australia years ago. I think it came out in the 90s, possibly even earlier, called The Wonderful World of Dogs. And the filmmaker actually made a doggy level camera and was running along the streets with this camera at sidewalk level following the dogs in this city. And it was really a perspective about dog culture.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing that's interesting, and you know, back to the film for a second, is that she's asking us to think about the ways in which we perceive and see the world. And of course, other beings help us deepen the ways in which we see, and also encounters with the inevitable, like death and birth. The film begins with a story about a dream she had, imagining her birthing Lola Bell.
I mean, that's right.
So there's death and there's birth and there's dogs and there's music, and it's really quite extraordinary, I think. So, well, we'll talk more about that one to come. But
yeah, we hope to.
It's on our brains.
We hope to have Laurie Anderson on the Radio Cafe one of these days soon too. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, Lola Bell is a rat terrier. So let's talk about, we're talking to Jason Silverman, who's director of the Cinematheque at the CCA. Every year at one point or another, we have this conversation about where the film industry is at. And a lot of things have changed over the years for a number of reasons. One is that the cost of equipment went down so low that filmmaking became accessible to many more people than it was before. Same with still photography. And the other is that there are ongoing changes in how films are watched and distributed.
Right. Yeah, it's a watershed period. Maybe it'll continue to be a watershed period, but you can imagine a book of cinema, a history of cinema, being written in 30 years and focusing the bulk of its attention on, you know, the birth of cinema in 1896 and the birth of Hollywood in the, you know, 19 teens and 20s, and then this moment now, you know, it's really one of the key moments. And you're right, you know, cinema was always such a capital intensive project that only the few could make movies, and that meant that only a certain kind of stories were getting told. And once we had cameras on our phones, you know, anyone and editing systems that would put, you know, the 1990s systems to shame, pre-installed in every Macintosh, and storage space, and, you know,
right.
All of this means that anyone can tell their story. It doesn't mean they can tell their story well or that we care to watch it, but anyone can tell their story, and that means that there's a lot more stories out there, and that means that the way that we receive these stories has to change and is changing. So how do we watch today as opposed to how we watched in the 50s? You know, before TV, we all went to the movies on a weekly basis. Then we started watching TV. We still went to the movies. Now we've got movies in our pocket at any given moment. And are we still going to go to the movies? How much are we going to go to the movies?
Yeah, we might be at home binge-watching House of Cards.
Right. Yeah, Theo watched 17 episodes of Star Trek while feeling sick, my kid, this weekend.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's an intense moment. And those of us who are in the industry, you know, we're kind of looking around and trying to read the tea leaves and figure out what happens next.
And nobody knows.
Nobody knows, no.
But for you, as a filmmaker, you're still doing things that you might have done 35 years ago, which is going from festival to festival, having the film distributed, it's opening at different actual theaters that serve popcorn all over the country, really all over the world. And so in that sense, there's a continuity.
There is. It doesn't mean it's a viable business model. So, you know, people will keep on making movies because they love making movies. So it's an open question what will happen next. You know, there could have been a scenario by which we made this movie as a YouTube series. You know, a series of shorter bits that was ongoing. And maybe we would have had a bigger audience. It would have been more financially viable doing it that way. It's hard to know.
And there is the, kind of as we were talking about with the series on exhibitions, there is something about a big, luscious, beautiful screen on which to watch things.
Yeah. We just showed the film at the Walker Art Institute in Minneapolis, and they've got, you know, state-of-the-art system and a giant screen. It's a totally beautiful house. And seeing the film there, you know, with the surround sound, and it was really a magnificent experience. I, for me, and I think for the rest of the audience too. So it's. I don't think that's going to go away, but it certainly has more and more competition, especially with younger people. You'll see, the box office trends are in rapid flux too. I knew when my mom called me for to try to help her set up her Amazon Prime live streaming onto her big screen at home. I knew we were in a moment of transition.
Right, exactly.
You know, she wants to watch those films on demand now.
Yeah.
And she's got a long list of films she wants to watch.
Right.
And will that mean she's going to go to the theater less? Probably does. And will it mean that the kinds of, you know, slightly off-center films and documentaries she goes to see will get less attendance? Probably does.
If she was going to those films in the first place, that's the big question.
Well, she does, and I think the people who are intellectually curious and have a sense of adventure in terms of the culture they seek out, those people have really broad options now. I mean, it's quite incredible. I mean, I feel daunted by all of the great films I have the opportunity to see at any given moment. So, you know, if I wasn't working upstairs from a couple movie theaters, I'd probably go to the movies a little less.
Now, what about Hollywood? I mean, how is the studio system faring?
I don't know. The studio system is such a complex organism.
I was thinking about that when Netflix produced its first TV series and, you know, they went from being a distributor to being a producer.
Well, I will tell you that at Sundance 5 years ago, the question was, how can you get Fox Searchlight and Sony Pictures Classics and the Weinstein Company and Focus Features to come watch your film? Now you're wondering, how can you get the Netflix and Amazon executives to come watch your film?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not making that up. I mean, you know, these companies now, and it also includes some companies that are kind of invested in multiple, Magnolia and IFC, they've got TV stations and theaters. And so, but these companies now are the ones that have the open checkbooks. They're the ones who are looking for content. And I think filmmakers are getting used to the idea that their films are going to be seen mainly on small screens. Beast of No Nation, which just opened, which is an Oscar contender, it was a Netflix film. Netflix produced it. They released it simultaneously worldwide and in theaters. I mean, in theaters worldwide and on Netflix. And they said they had their biggest viewership for an original piece yet. That was on October 16th. So that's maybe the model where showing it in theater is really just a way of marketing its availability on the small screen.
Right. Amazing. Well, Jason Silverman, we look forward to continuing this conversation, especially when Semben finally is released here in Santa Fe. Jason Silverman is a filmmaker. He's director of the Cinematheque at the CCA. And once again, the first in the series called The Masters, Exhibitions on Screen, opens tomorrow at the CCA. It's called The Impressionists. And the following weekend is Girl with a Pearl Earring and Other Treasures from the Mauritshuis in Amsterdam. And it goes on from there. Is it Amsterdam? No, it's in The Hague. Anyway, Jason Silverman, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Mary Charlotte, a great pleasure as always.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.